You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Troy Oppie, in today for Gemma Gaudette. And it is Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. That's when we get you up to date on all the news that made headlines this past week. Today, our panel includes Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, Rachel Spacek with the Idaho Press, and our South Central Idaho reporter here at Boise State Public Radio, Rachel Cohen. Hello, everyone. Happy Friday. Thanks for being here.
Hello.
Happy Friday.
Hi, Troy.
Rachel Cohen, let's start with you. The news of the week, and we just heard your report on businesses taking steps to bring the vaccine within their doors and administer it to employees. And Idaho has accelerated its vaccine availability. Anyone over 16 with a medical condition can get the shot starting Monday, and then everyone will be eligible 1 week later. Things have been sped up by nearly a month. What triggered this decision this week?
Yes, well, this is something I would say we're seeing across the country as states really ramping up their vaccine timeline. Part of that is because President Biden directed states to make their adult populations eligible by May 1st. So the vast majority of states right now have made pledges to do that. And so Idaho's initial goal of, I think, April 26th would have meant that May 1st deadline, but then, like you said, this week it was sped up even more. Health officials said this week that decision was driven by a mix of supply and demand, so we're expecting more doses in the coming weeks, but really I would say it was driven by demand and the situation on the ground, which is that providers in some parts of the state were having trouble filling appointments with people who were already eligible. So the thinking is if you open up the gates wider, the demand will fill in those slots, at least for the near future.
Well, and it seems like the state has found some good success with the vaccine pre-registration system. I registered on that and actually got a phone call on Wednesday offering an appointment. Do we know how many people have registered for that system? And what else do we know about how it's working so far?
Yeah, yesterday, Department of Health and Welfare tweeted that 95,000 Idahoans had pre-registered through that statewide system, and that 38,000 people had been contacted by providers through that system. Again, that's when people sign up saying that they want to get a vaccine, here are the counties that I want to get it in, and then the providers contact those people through that system. Doesn't necessarily mean that's how many appointments have been set up through this arrangement, but those are how many people have been contacted, like yourself.
The state says more than 406,000 people have been vaccinated with at least one shot. There's a significant amount of federal emergency funding that's helping to pay for a lot of this distribution. And that's funding that states or local governments probably can't get unless they have a declared emergency. Rachel Spacek, using full names because we do have two Rachels on the show today, you covered a Canyon County Commission meeting where public testimony was largely against continuing that county's emergency declaration. And there was reasoning that several people who testified used that doesn't seem to stack up. What happened in Canyon County this week?
Yeah, so basically, I've kind of been following a few of these meetings because the county set up its COVID declaration a year ago just to be passed every month or so, instead of kind of using till whenever we decide to end it. These meetings have continued for the last year, and in recent months, I've been seeing public testimony at these meetings or emails to county officials saying, I don't want you to extend this this emergency declaration because I don't want a mask mandate or I don't want a countywide business closure to be issued. And, the point is, this is similar to what we kind of saw in the legislature, which was, the counties, from the county's perspective, the declaration at this point opens it up to potential federal funding for COVID relief. And also the original point of the emergency declaration is to allow the county to make easier purchases of PPE or whatever emergency equipment they need. You know, it allows them to stay open and have open communication among their entities. So, you know, I kind of had to dispel a little bit of disinformation this week just to tell people that, you know, Canyon County has never had a mask mandate. You know, I was sitting in this meeting last week and, you know, I and one other person were wearing a mask. So it was just kind of like, there's obviously no mask mandate because most people in this room aren't wearing a mask. And, you know, businesses have been open for a year. So, I mean, people are obviously sick of the impacts of the pandemic and are upset, you know, if they've lost their jobs, which is really, you know, that has had an impact in the county, but, you know, to take it out on this emergency declaration is just incorrect.
What's the feedback to that reporting, Ben? Are you getting comments from folks that say this emergency declaration actually has cost me in a very specific way?
So I haven't heard directly from people, but I've heard from at least one county commissioner who's told me that people have lost their jobs because they refuse to wear a mask, and maybe the business itself, you know, requires its employees to wear a mask just as its own thing. And, you know, if you refuse to wear a mask, but your boss wants you to wear a mask, that's obviously in their discretion to fire you or not. So that's the only thing I've heard. I know, you know, I haven't heard anything directly from my reporting. So hopefully people read it and realize that there is no mask mandate. And then this whole conversation will come back up at the middle of April. So we'll see what happens.
All right, we're going to circle back to the pandemic in an upcoming segment here. Don, I want to get to a story you did this week on the Idaho Transportation Department, hitting the brakes on a proposal that's unlike anything most drivers have ever seen, a wrong side of the road left turn setup that was proposed for the intersection of Highway 44, State Street, and Eagle Road. What's this thing actually called, and why did ITD make a U-turn on this idea? If I can pack any more puns in there, I would have. But what's going on?
I just realized as you were winding up that I talked about this last time I was on with Gemma and failed horribly in describing it, and now I'm in the same position. So State Street and Eagle Road in Eagle. State Street is also known as Highway 44. They're going to redo the intersection there. And they were going to essentially set it up so that folks who were traveling on State Street who wanted to make a turn would divert to the wrong side of the road and then make their turn from there. What that does, in theory, is makes it move a little quicker. ITD rolled this out last month. They did segments on local TV stations. They got a big write-up in the newspaper. Boise Dev didn't actually cover it because we had mentioned it about a year ago, so we kind of skipped it. We got a tip a few weeks ago that after the outcry, they changed their mind. And sure enough, Vince Trimboli at ITD, I know an old friend of many in the media, said, yeah, we're thinking about it. And then this week they said, we're going to change course. We got feedback here that this isn't what folks wanted, and we're gonna do a still do a redo of the intersection, but it'll be more traditional. So when you're making those left-hand turns, you won't first go to the wrong side of the road to make it. You asked what this is called. It's called a partial continuous flow intersection. They're not that uncommon across the U.S., but it would have been the first here in Idaho, and people didn't like it, so they changed their mind.
change. No, get it away. But there are still some time saving measures in what ITD has planned for this intersection, correct? Because right now, you know, they say average wait time is somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 minutes, and that is going to get better either with the, you know, the dramatic change to turning from the wrong side of the road or what they're now planning to do instead, which is more traditional.
Yeah, for sure. And ITD essentially said that there would be less time savings, but it still would save time. I asked Vince over at ITD if this was sort of maybe a long-term problem, because eventually things will gum up and get worse. And he said, yeah, you know, it will that savings loss will compound over time. So, you know, it's these things are interesting. Balancing what the public wants with what is the right call, I think, is difficult for anybody, especially government. And I was a little surprised because they were pretty splashy about this and mm-hmm. linked to or they did a lot of media on it, produced a pretty fancy video showing people and getting them ready for it. And the comment threads on some of the larger news outlets in town were not very positive. They're rarely positive, but in this case,
right,
especially.
Right. As long as we're talking about ITD, maybe it's worth mentioning that Highway 55 is back open again, although it's just a single lane alternating traffic, 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. That's between Smiths Ferry and the Rainbow Bridge after an unexpected rock slide closed the highway for a week. That's near where crews have already been working for months, blowing holes in the rock's face to expand the road. Don, remind us of the timeline for this project. And I know you spend a lot of time in McCall. You know a lot of people up there. What has the problem this week and this ongoing construction kind of meant to the business climate in Valley County?
Yeah, you know, this is a story we followed really closely, and we don't typically do road closures, but we do really try and cover news that affects people traveling between Boise and McCall. And both our Gretchen Parsons and Autumn Robertson have been following this, and it's a pretty big slide. ITD put out some photos and showed people rappelling down the slide. And though I can't get a measuring tape out there, I can kind of look at it and say, boy, it's like 20 people tall when you compare the little tiny person to the very large boulders. And you know, you ask about that business impact, and I know Tamarack Resort has seen some slowdown in business. People can get to McCall. It's not that you can't. You just have to go
right.
Highway 95, and it depends on where you live. It can take a little longer. Sometimes I like taking that route, frankly, because it's a little less windy, and we have dogs, and they slosh around the back of the car through that canyon, so we'll go the other way. So it's not like it's 5 hours versus 2.5, but it is a little longer. So yeah, there is an impact, and you know, I call that Idaho's main north-south link. Some people disagree with that, but based on traffic volume, more people use Idaho 55 versus 95. And it's a major route for commerce and tourism. It was closed. I mean, hard closed basically for a full week. ITD told me that they were able to get some first responders through, and there's actually a child who lives in the area who needed to get to school. They were able to transport. And now it's open, but it's only kind of open. 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. each day in one direction alternating is a fairly limiting factor for people who want to get from Boise to McCall. Or frankly, it's even harder if you're trying to get from say, Smiths Ferry to Cascade, mm-hmm. because there's right. not a quick way to do that. There is a shortcut in the area that I think locals are familiar with, but it's a pretty big challenge, and it's hard to say how long this is going to go. You know, one thing I think that's important, Troy and Sam told me you might ask about this, is ITD is saying that this is not related to the construction. And you read that and you go, well, really? I mean, they've been, as you said, blasting holes in the rock, and they just restarted for the spring a couple weeks ago. Vince Tremoli at ITD said that the slide location is about a half a mile from where they were blasting. And so they, at least for now, think that it's not related. It'll be interesting to see what they say long-term, because it is certainly something that makes you wonder when they start blowing holes in rock and then big rocks fall down in the same area.
The U.S. House of Representatives passed the Farm Workforce Modernization Act this week. Rachel Spacek, you reported on what some of the impact of that bill might be here in Idaho. Tell us more about what that legislation means for Idaho farms and it sounds like dairies in particular.
Yes. So we've been kind of hearing about this, or at least, I mean, people who follow ag have been hearing about this since last year. So it's basically, you know, as a whole, it's aimed to address the you know, insecurity and also, you know, short staffing issues in Idaho ag and ag nationwide. Basically, the issue is a shortage of workers and also, you know, as everyone I think is aware at this point, a lot of the ag workers here and across the US are undocumented, you know, and so they're at risk of deportation, you know, every time they are in the car or kind of just going about their daily lives. And that has an impact on their employers, obviously, because, you know, you have a risk of your employee getting deported. And so, you know, a bipartisan coalition kind of got together to aim to address that. So basically what we're seeing in the actual bill is workers who have put in 180 days of ag employment over the last 2 years would be either able to apply for a 5-year visa that's renewable or apply for lawful permanent residency. And that's also for their families as well. So it would offer a path to citizenship for them. And so that obviously addresses the deportation issue and kind of makes maybe making the trek to from their country to the US, you know, more favorable. And then it also makes changes to the H-2A visa program because so dairies aren't part of the visa program because they require kind of year-round employees, and the visa program is just you know, in the spring and summer. So that's really appealing for Idaho dairies. And you know, I saw a list of all of the ag entities in Idaho that have signed on in support of this, and I think it's every ag entity, you know, hops, dairies, everyone, just because, you know, I think they've been struggling with this workforce, and this is kind of a path to that. And then, yeah, it would also help with wage reform and grants for farm worker housing, because that's another issue I've been following a little bit, is the lack of farm worker housing available. And so it passed the House. After I wrote the story, I actually heard from Senator Mike Crapo's staff, and he said he's not going to support it in the Senate, but will be coming up with his own version. So I will be looking out for that, and we'll have more to report when we hear what his bill is.
Hmm. How critical is the worker shortage that this bill aims to address? Do we know specifics of that?
I don't know specifics. And the problem is there's nothing in the state to show how many undocumented workers there are in ag in Idaho. So I'm not sure about that. But nationwide, 50% of the workforce is undocumented. So that's, wow. You know, that's a huge number. And, you know, I don't know what the shortage exactly looks like, but the deportation issue, you know, when half of the workers are undocumented and at risk of deportation, you know, that's a problem for the ag industry.
Farmers are, of course, eager to get restaurants back to full capacity. And Dawn, it's been tough sledding for the hospitality industry. We know this throughout the pandemic, but there are plenty of expansions and new ventures opening up as well. Tell us more about what you've reported coming to downtown Boise this week.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of new things coming to downtown Boise. And Troy, I forget which story I pitched, and I'm like, which?
So there's something new coming to the Dharma, the old Dharma sushi
location. Oh, yeah,
okay.
So I apologize. So Mala Luna, a new Latin-inspired restaurant and bar that will come to the corner of Capitol Boulevard and Idaho Street. Dharma Sushi, which used to be in this location across from Boise City Hall, moved about 3 blocks away just before the first of the year. Mala Luna is headed up by the folks who brought you Boise Fry Company. They also own the Press and Pony and Ramapong in that building. So trying a new concept here, and it looks kind of interesting. They say that it's going to have kind of both a Latin and Native American flair to it. So we haven't seen the menu just yet, but I'm curious to see what they do here and try a new restaurant. And there's really a couple that are happening in a similar vein. The folks that brought you Barbacoa will do Koa Dejima on Main Street, so like a block and a half away, that also will really focus on sort of tequila forward cocktails in downtown.
Well, and I think an indication of how many of these things are happening as different different restaurants move around and expand, that you know, that being surprised by which one I was talking about is not all that uncommon. Also this week, reports of some public frustration over two proposed development projects. Don, we'll come back to you in a second, but Rachel Cohen, tell us who wants to build an airstrip near Stanley in Custer County.
So this is a proposal being put forward by Michael and Amanda Boren. If that name sounds familiar, it's because the Borens have been kind of at the center of a couple controversies in the Stanley area. The brothers, I believe, were co-founders of the Boise company, Clearwater Analytics. And this new proposal is for an airstrip south of Stanley on land that Michael Boren owns. Last summer, there was a different incident at a different property where Michael was allegedly flying a low-flying helicopter, I believe, over a construction crew on his brother's property, which, you know, they were building a trail from Stanley Center to Redfish Lake, and had been fighting the Forest Service for a couple years on that construction. So this new proposal, again, an airstrip 15 miles south of Stanley, comes up before the Custer County Planning and Zoning Commission next week, and kind of stirred some of similar complaints from locals this week, basically about the development in the Sawtooth National Recreation Area, which is where this property lies.
But this would be a private airstrip, correct?
Yes, that's correct. And you know, part of the argument among folks I heard was that there are two other airstrips in the area, both about 10 miles from this site, which is private, and the other two are public.
Don, the other development proposal raising eyebrows this week is in Meridian, the southwest corner of Eustick and Eagle Road. It looks like that's, I think, currently a big open lot in an, you know, the whole area is just teeming with new retail growth. What's the plan there, and the very public now pushback?
Yeah, so this is the site of a proposed large athletic club called Villa Sport, but there's some additional land that's closer to the corner. And Brian Tsai wants to build a 7,000 square foot nightclub he calls the Oasis on this corner. Boise Dev's Autumn Robertson watched this public meeting this week, and it was pretty testy. It went about 3 hours, which is quite a long time for a planning and zoning meeting. And folks are upset about the things that folks are often upset about, lanes of traffic, noise, but then some things specific to potentially a nightclub, like drunk driving, security, and things like that. The applicant was pretty upset and pretty fired up, saying that some of the comments were the result of a smear campaign against his business and his proposal. It went on for quite a while. The Planning and Zoning Commission punted for now. They asked Tsai to go back and make some changes to work out a cross-access parking agreement with the folks who own Villa Sport, which wasn't currently in place, and make some other changes, including working more closely with Meridian Police on safety protocol. And then they can come back in May and have another shot at this to get approved. And I've heard from a number of sources on this story that there are concerns on just how this would impact the area and what might happen at this club in terms of Meridian's approach to growth and development. So we'll see where this goes. I imagine after planning and zoning, it will probably go to Meridian City Council, and it's something we'll be following for a while as this moves along.
Don, I'm going to put you on the spot here, so sorry in advance, but 7,000 feet of a nightclub, how does that compare size-wise to some of the existing venues in town, in Garden City, in downtown Boise? Can you kind of compare those at all?
Yeah, so we did a story in 2018 on the Knitting Factory, and that's about 15,000 square feet.
Okay.
Ooh, Troy, you didn't stump me, and I'm amazed. So we're talking about.
I love that. We'll do it.
Yeah. I know. I was like, oh, I'm going to fail. It's about half the size of the Knitting Factory. So if you've been in that venue, it's a fairly large concert house space, and then there's space upstairs. So, you know, you think of the average newer home in the Boise area is between 2,000 and 2,500 square feet. So we're talking mm-hmm. about like three of those. So I wouldn't actually call it huge, especially because the Villasport building that's going to go next door is really big. If I remember, we'll see if I can look that up. That's 130,000 square feet. So a lot bigger. So in that scale, is it really huge? I don't know. But I think people hear nightclub and their antennas go up, and that may be what's at play here.
According to data from Johns Hopkins University and the New York Times COVID tracker, about one in every 10 Idaho residents have contracted COVID-19. Rachel Cohen, you've been following some COVID long haulers, and these are people with persistent symptoms long after the initial illness, symptoms in many cases ongoing, even with a negative test.
Yes, we checked in with some people who had lingering COVID symptoms, kind of as part of our look at what the pandemic looks like a year out. And so I spoke with one woman who initially got sick back when Blaine County saw its initial surge last March. And her symptoms lasted for a long time. By the time we spoke, she was feeling mostly better, although she experienced some fatigue. That's probably the symptom that I think has been the most persistent. And, you know, it's just been really interesting. I don't know if I want to say interesting, but depressing talking to folks who have been kind of searching for answers for a long, long time. And I think it goes to show that, you know, even as our hospitalization rates come down, case rates hopefully come down, and we're getting closer to this idea of a new normal, I think it's not the case for everyone. Certainly this is an illness that I don't think you want to have, even if you don't get severely hospitalized, because we just don't have a lot of answers as to the long-term effects right now.
Well, and it's a roll of the dice, right? You don't know if it's going to impact you severely, moderately. And these long haulers, they span age groups, don't they? There's no one particular age group that is more likely to be a long hauler, right?
Yes, from what I know, that is the case. I think it affects people of all ages. And interestingly, there is one clinic in Idaho that is dedicated to COVID long haulers at St. Alphonsus in Boise. And so through their work, where they see people who are experiencing these issues on a daily basis, they've come away with some answers. But the doctors there are still really eager for more scientific research, because there aren't a lot of official answers about the long-term effects right now.
And I guess anytime that there are so many unanswered questions, something creeps in to fill that void. And in some cases, that's fear or hate. And hate crimes overall have dropped slightly over the last year. But hate crimes specifically against Asian Americans has more than doubled. The killing of 8 people at multiple locations in Atlanta, 6 of whom were of Asian descent, has elevated this issue across the country in the last 10 days or so. Rachel Spacek, here in Boise, that has happened as well, right?
Yes. So, we've seen two kind of events to to kind of come together and following the violence, you know, in Atlanta and also just kind of the violence in general. We've seen, according to multiple sources, violence against Asian Americans has gone up by 145%, I think. So it's a huge increase, and kind of we've seen this coming together of the community to say, you know, that's not okay, and you know, this is something that we need to support our Asian American Pacific Islander neighbors. And you know, I asked the Idaho Human Rights Commission about you know, the collection of data in Idaho about hate crimes against various groups. I was specifically asking about Asian Americans, but it's unfortunately not collected at all in Idaho. So we don't know exactly, but I did get an email from a reader following my coverage of the vigil on Tuesday saying, you know, I've never heard of any hate crimes against Asian Americans in Idaho. And, you know, just from what I know in my coverage of Latinos in Canyon County, you know, just because you don't hear about this hate against minority groups doesn't mean it doesn't happen. And, you know, I think we all would like to believe that it wouldn't happen in our city, but, you know, trends say it likely has. So, yeah.
Well, and it sounds like that one of the organizers of one of those two rallies that was done at the Idaho Capitol is just a Boise High sophomore, and she has plans to do more of these and raise more awareness around this issue. Did she tell you more about how she wanted to continue to bring this to the forefront of the conversation here in Idaho?
Yeah, so she definitely mentioned she wants to you know, bring together groups of young people of color, you know, not just Asian Americans, but, you know, bringing all of the young people who feel a call to action given the recent violence against people of color. But she specifically, you know, her experience in school in Boise, I think, you know, she mentioned, you know, some racism she's felt from fellow students. So she's really focusing on the education piece, because in talking to her, she said she feels that the racism she has faced comes from a lack of education around other cultures and, you know, accepting people for who they are. So she mentioned, you know, bringing together all people of color and trying to get some education forward and I don't know her specific ways, but that was kind of her goal.
And just another example, perhaps, too, that, you know, just because you don't hear about something doesn't mean it's not going on in your backyard or right under your nose.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you know, to that point, at the vigil on Tuesday, you know, multiple young Asian Americans got up. One woman talked about the racism and microaggressions her mother faces as a nurse in Idaho. So yeah, you know, just to your point, you know, just because we don't see it doesn't mean that it doesn't happen. And it's something that we should be sensitive to.
Thanks for that reporting. Dawn, there's a continued, I don't know, a city hall intrigue, perhaps, with former Boise Fire Chief Dennis Doan, who's now the fire chief in Gig Harbor, Washington, which is outside Seattle. In the couple minutes we have left here, remind us of the timeline with the former Boise Fire Chief and the discomfort of his departure, and then the new information that's emerged this week.
Dennis Doan. Oh, sorry, you cut out, so I might have talked over you, but a year ago, Dennis Doan resigned his post as the chief of Boise Fire after about 12 years. He'd worked for the department for almost 30 years. That came after some back and forth with Boise Mayor Lauren McLean, who had asked Doan to resign, essentially, and put an offer of severance in front of him. My sources tell me that that was a $50,000 offer. He said he wanted $100,000. The mayor came back and made a counter offer that was short of that $100K, and Mr. Doan rejected that. He then went out and held a news conference in front of Boise City Hall last March, and took some questions from the media. And I asked him at the time if he thought it was political, and he said, quote, "You'll have to ask her." We did ask her, and the mayor wouldn't comment, citing personnel policies and laws in the state of Idaho. And a week, almost 2 weeks ago, I tweeted, you know, gosh, we've never really found out what happened with this, which caused a source to reach out and say, you know what, it's been a year, I'll give you the story. So we went and tried to confirm what happened in that with a number of other sources and put together a fairly detailed timeline of what we know there. And it also includes comment from Dennis Stone on what he says happened. And it's a fairly extensive piece that you can read on boisedev.com. And I think for the first time, we really actually do get a sense of just what happened a year ago with this fairly high profile exit that happened right at the beginning of Mayor McLean's time in office.
You can read that at boisedev.com. And we've been speaking with Don Day, the founder and editor of that website, on our reporter roundtable today. Rachel Spacek with the Idaho Press, thanks to her for joining us, certainly. And our South Central Idaho reporter, Rachel Cohen. Appreciate all your time and contributions on the show today. Have a great weekend.